All right. The book of Daniel. The book of Daniel was written by Daniel, who was one of the captives of Judah taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar in the year 606 BC. He arrived in Babylon as a young man and remained there for the rest of his life, serving in the court of the Babylonian and Persian kings. He was made the head over all of the wise men in the realm and was the personal friend and counselor to Nebuchadnezzar, Darius the Mede, and Cyrus the Persian. So Daniel is a very extraordinary person in biblical history, in character and in his position, very similar to Joseph, a man of just absolute integrity and godly character, and looked up to and admired and sought after by these ancient, essentially pagan rulers. So had a tremendous impact within the Babylonian and the Persian court. The theme of Daniel is the rise and fall of the kingdoms of this world and the coming kingdom of the Messiah. So that's the essence of what the prophecies are about. The prophecies, language, and imagery of Daniel are similar to the book of Revelation. So Daniel is sort of the Old Testament version, really, of the book of Revelation. And Daniel sort of split down the middle. The first six chapters of Daniel are chronicling events in Daniel's personal life, things that transpired and happened to him, beginning with his deportation to Babylon, and then some of the different things that transpired as he served there in the Babylonian and the Persian court. The second half of Daniel, chapter 7 through the end, are predominantly prophecies, visions that Daniel had, and the laying out of the vision, then the interpretation of the vision given. So Daniel is both, it's got that historical, biographical aspect to it, but then it's got that strong prophetic aspect to it as well. The key chapters in Daniel, probably chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 9, and chapter 12. All of the chapters are great. We're going to take an overview of each one of them here in a minute. But, you know, look, as far as key chapters, these chapters 2, 7, 9, and 12 are the ones that really sort of spell out the whole big picture of what's happening in regard to the kingdoms of this world and in regard to the Messianic kingdom. Key verses would be probably chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Those are the verses that deal with the 70-week prophecy. We'll come back and look at that in more detail in a few minutes. And then connected to that would be chapter 12, verses 7 through 11. So we'll come back to those, but let's just take kind of an overview of each of the chapters of Daniel now. In chapter 1, we have the record of the deportation to Babylon. We find that Daniel arrives in Babylon as a young man, and because he's a good-looking young man and an intelligent young man, he's immediately recruited by Nebuchadnezzar to serve in his court. So there's this preparation period that is going to transpire where these young men are groomed to serve in the court. And it's early on and in his youth still that Daniel begins to show his commitment, his integrity as a young man of God. And there in the court, he makes a decision, or there in the preparation for the court, he makes a decision that he's not going to defile himself with the king's delicacies. Of course, Daniel is a Jew. He is committed to abiding by the Mosaic dietary laws. And he comes to Babylon, and of course, they're going to be providing food for him that would be in violation of those laws. Daniel takes a stand early on and says, I'm not going to partake of the king's delicacies. And this potentially could have caused a problem for those that were overseeing him. But Daniel says, look, let's kind of do a test. Me and my friends, we will just serve us water and vegetables for 10 days. And then at the end of 10 days, check us out. And if we're sickly, if we're weak, if we're feeble, if it looks like we're not going to make it, then we'll do something else. But if we're doing well, then let us abide by this. So at the end of 10 days, they were looking better, feeling better, and sharper than all of the other young men that were being trained and eating the king's delicacies. So as a result of that, Daniel honors God by, keeping his commitment to the law. And then God turns around and honors Daniel and gives him and his three friends favor in the king's court. So from the very earliest stages, God gives them this favorable status there with the leadership. And, in that, I mean, there's something to that. It's not necessarily the case in every situation. I mean, sometimes you honor the Lord and you get persecuted for it. But, quite often as well, when we stand up and just, go with our convictions, not being, arrogant about it, but just simply, this is my commitment, this is my conviction, this is what I'm going to do. It can turn around to be a real blessing. And God will quite often honor a person who makes that kind of a stand. So this is what happens in the first chapter. Now, in the second chapter, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream that is extremely troubling. And how many of you guys are familiar with the book of Daniel? Everybody here pretty familiar with it? Okay. So you guys know it's the dream of the image, and it's got the head of gold and the chest of silver and, all the way down to the feet of iron and clay and all of that. So Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and in the dream, the image is struck by this massive stone, and it crumbles. And Nebuchadnezzar wakes up, and he's just extremely shaken over this dream. And he desperately wants to know what this dream means. And he knows the tendency of his counselors, his wise men, and so forth. Their tendency is going to be to, if they don't know the interpretation, to invent one. So he doesn't want that to happen because he really desperately wants to know the meaning of the dream. So he calls all of them together and he says, okay, here's the deal. I had a dream and I need to know the interpretation, but I'm not going to tell you the dream because if I tell you the dream, you'll just make up an interpretation. So you're going to have to tell me what I dreamed, then I know you can give me the interpretation. And of course, these guys said, that is ridiculous. There's no king that's ever required anything like that of anybody. We can't tell you the dream. He says, well, that's the rules, and if you don't do it, I'm going to kill you all. Nebuchadnezzar was, he was a tyrant, to say the least. And so the decree went out to kill the wise men because they couldn't come up with the dream, and the process of eliminating them began, and Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they were part of that group. So they were set to also be executed. So Daniel goes to his superior and he says, why is the king's command so hasty? He said, give us time. And we will give the dream and the interpretation. So they prayed together. God revealed to Daniel what the dream was and the interpretation. Daniel was brought before Nebuchadnezzar. You know the story. And he tells Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was. And in telling him what his dream was, Nebuchadnezzar knew, all right, this guy can tell me the interpretation. So Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, the God of heaven has shown you the future. This image is a picture of the kingdoms that will follow your kingdom that will culminate with the God of heaven setting up his own kingdom on the earth. And so, you know, he says to Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold, but there's a kingdom that's going to replace you. It's inferior to you. And then that will be replaced by another kingdom that's even inferior. And then a fourth kingdom that will be inferior to that. But then ultimately, this stone that you saw that was cut without human hands, this is a picture of God's kingdom coming. And of course, the Messiah coming and the kingdoms of this world being obliterated and God's kingdom being established and going on perpetually. So this is the second chapter. Now, when we come to the third chapter, and Nebuchadnezzar is extremely impressed with Daniel and with this interpretation, and he receives it, and he understands that this is definitely something that's come from God. But after a while, evidently, he thought about it and decided, I don't like that dream. I don't like the idea of my kingdom being replaced by another kingdom. And so he made an image. Remember, he saw an image in his dream. So he makes an image, and the image is made of gold entirely. So he's basically saying, no, my kingdom is going to go on forever. There's not going to be the succession of kingdoms. And he then, of course, gave a decree that at a certain time, when the music played, everybody was to bow down to this image that he had made. So word gets back to Nebuchadnezzar that three of his chief advisors are not participating in this worship. And these would be the friends of Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, known to Nebuchadnezzar as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So when they came into Babylon, when they were deported into Babylon, what they did is they gave them Babylonian names. And the Babylonian names were names that were derived from the Babylonian gods. Daniel was given the name Belteshazzar. And yet throughout the book, he's mostly referred to as Daniel. But these three other guys became known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So again, you remember the story. Nebuchadnezzar gets word that they're not cooperating. He calls them in. Is this true? He says to them, is it true that you're not bowing and worshiping? Surely this can't be true. I mean, you guys are my you're my loyal advisors and so forth. And so he says, you know, I'm going to give you another chance. Just, you know, we'll strike up the music and we'll give you an opportunity to show that there's nothing to these accusations. And of course, they said, well, King, actually, it is true. And we're not going to bow down and worship your image. And then Nebuchadnezzar threatened them, you know, if you don't bow down and do this, I'm going to throw you in the fiery furnace. And their response, you remember, was, well, if that's what you're going to do, that's what you're going to do. Our God is able to protect us, but even if he chooses not to, King, we're not going to bow down and worship your image. And we read there that Nebuchadnezzar's countenance was changed, and he was enraged that they would resist his will. And so he has the furnace heated 7 times hotter. It's heated to such an extent that the men who are throwing them into the furnace are consumed in the fire themselves. But they're bound hand and foot. They're thrown into the midst of the furnace. And then you remember, after a period of time, Nebuchadnezzar is able to look into the furnace, and he turns and he says, did we not throw three men in the furnace? How is it that I see four men loose and walking in the midst of the fire, and one of them looks like the Son of God? And then, of course, they were called out of the fiery furnace. And again, Nebuchadnezzar has this revelation that the God, their God is the God of Daniel as well. And so he, you know, has some repentance there. But he's still not completely broken. So we come to the fourth chapter. And the fourth chapter is one of the greatest testimonies you'll ever read. It is the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar, how he was converted. This is the amazing thing. This guy, Nebuchadnezzar, probably the greatest monarch in all of human history, the greatest in the sense that he had absolute and total power. And this is the guy who destroyed Jerusalem. This is the guy who crushed all of the surrounding nations and brought the world into submission to himself. This guy, through Daniel's influence, gets converted. He becomes a believer in the God of the Bible, and Daniel chapter 4 is Nebuchadnezzar's testimony. And it's totally an amazing story about how God humbled him. And he tells the story himself, and that's what the fourth chapter is. So it's interesting that the fourth chapter of the book of Daniel was written by King Nebuchadnezzar. Isn't that an amazing thing to think? So that's his contribution to the book. It's his testimony. And of course, you remember perhaps what happened where he was lifted up with pride and was continuing to resist, humbling himself before God, and he again has a dream, and he's very troubled by this dream. In the dream, he sees this great tree, this massive tree that was full of fruit and blessing to the nations and protection for the people. He sees this, and all of a sudden, there's a voice that calls out, "Cut down the tree." The tree is to be cut down, but leave the stump. And so he awakes from this dream, and he's troubled by this, but he knows where to go. He calls for Daniel. And he tells Daniel the dream, and he says, "Daniel, what is the interpretation of the dream?" And here's where you see Daniel's heart toward the king. He's grown, to like Nebuchadnezzar. He has affection toward him. And when he hears the dream, he says, "Oh, king, may this dream be about your enemies, not about you." Nebuchadnezzar says, well, what is it? And he says, "Well, you, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the tree. You've become great, and God has blessed you, and he's prospered you, and you've become a father to all of these nations and so forth. But because of your pride, you're going to be cut down. And you're going to be like a stump." But then he goes on to tell him, "You're going to be driven from men, and you're going to live in the fields, and you're going to eat grass like a cow, and your hair is going to grow, and your nails are going to grow like birds' claws and birds' feathers, and all of this is going to happen until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men." So Nebuchadnezzar receives the word from Daniel. But it doesn't happen immediately. Daniel advises him. He says, "Okay, this is the dream, but Daniel's thinking, maybe we can avoid this. You need to repent." That's basically what he tells him. But he doesn't repent. And a year passes, and Nebuchadnezzar is walking in his palace. Now, Babylon, the description of Babylon from ancient writers was so fantastical that people suspected that it was embellished, that it couldn't have been, there's no way that this city could have been as great as these writers describe it. Well, when they finally were able to begin to excavate it, they found out that what the ancient writer said about it was absolutely true. It would, you know, far surpass any modern city as far as the architecture and the beauty and all of that. It was amazing. And Nebuchadnezzar is basically the one who built the whole thing. He reigned for 45 years, and in that time, he just, you know, built the entire time. So he's walking around his palace saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built myself for my own glory? And we read there that as those words came from his mouth, the word came from heaven, Nebuchadnezzar, your kingdom is taken from you. And that fast, he went insane. And that's pretty radical judgment. In an instant, he went from being the great Nebuchadnezzar, suddenly he's on the ground, crawling around on all fours, mooing like a cow. And they eventually, you know, they lead him out. And he lives out in the fields till seven times pass over him. Nobody's exactly sure what seven times means. Was he out there for 7 years? Was it 7 months? Was it some other, you know, period of sevens? We don't know. Seven something passed. And finally, at the end of that period, his sanity was restored to him, and his former glory was given back to him. And at the end of the fourth chapter, he says, and therefore I praise and extol and worship the God of heaven. And an amazing testimony. But when we come to the fifth chapter, we come to the reign of his grandson. His grandson is named Belshazzar. And this is the story, you remember, where Belshazzar has this great feast. The Medes and the Persians are actually outside the city. They've surrounded the city, or they've laid siege against the city. They're trying to break in and conquer the city. But they are absolutely convinced that the city is impenetrable. Nobody's ever going to get in here. We're perfectly fine. We're safe. Let's have a party. And during the party, Belshazzar says, hey, let's bring out those vessels that came from the temple in Jerusalem. And so they took those sacred objects and they began to drink wine from them and eat their food from them. And it says they began to toast the gods with these sacred vessels that were made specifically for the worship of the true God. And as they were doing that, you remember suddenly there came a hand writing on the wall. You know how we use that phrase, hey man, the writing's on the wall. That's where it came from. There came a hand writing on the wall. And it says, meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. And so everybody's frightened to death. Belshazzar is frightened to death. What does this mean? Somebody interpret this for us. Again, nobody can interpret it. Typical story. Now, Daniel has evidently sort of been in retirement for quite some time because Nebuchadnezzar has gone off the scene. He's passed away. His son then became the king, but he had other interests, so he made Belshazzar his vice regent. So Belshazzar and his father, they reigned simultaneously, but Belshazzar was the one who reigned in Babylon. So Daniel had, like I said, evidently been out of the picture, but the queen mother comes in and says to Belshazzar, there is a man in your kingdom who can interpret this for you. He's the man who interpreted the dreams in the days of your grandfather. So Daniel was called in, and he's evidently an old man at this time. He's brought in, and Belshazzar says, you know, if you can interpret this, I'll give you a chain of gold and a robe, and you'll be made the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, that's an interesting thing. He's going to be made the third ruler in the kingdom. Why the third ruler? Because Belshazzar is the second ruler. His father is actually still ruling. Now, the reason I bring that up is because the critics have said that, you know, there's all kinds of historical inaccuracies in Daniel. Who is this Belshazzar guy? We don't have any record of him in history. For a long time, they said that. They did find some historical documentation for Belshazzar in that region. But for a long time, they said, you know, there was no king of Babylon named Belshazzar. He was the second in command. So he says to Daniel, you'll be third. And Daniel says this. He says, you keep your gifts, but I will tell you the meaning of the writing on the wall. And then he goes on to really rebuke Belshazzar. He goes back to Nebuchadnezzar. He tells the story about how God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. And he says to Belshazzar, he said, and you know all of this. You knew what happened to your grandfather, but look at what you've done. And then he says to him, this is the meaning of the writing. Meanie, meanie, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Tekel, divided, and you farsen to the Persians. So Daniel says, this is what it means. You've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Your kingdom is taken from you, and it's going to be given to the Persians, and it's going to happen tonight. You're going to die tonight. Man, radical. And sure enough, the impenetrable city of Babylon was penetrated by the Persians, by Cyrus, by Darius. And this was a fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. It was Isaiah who declared that God would open the gates and let them into Babylon so they could overthrow Babylon. And so it all comes to pass right there that night. And just as Daniel said, Belshazzar was slain that night, and the kingdom passed on to Darius the Mede, who received the kingdom at about 62 years old. So that brings us to chapter 6. And chapter 6 is the story of Daniel. Commonly, we refer to it as the story of Daniel in the lion's den. And so the Medes and the Persians take over from the Babylonians. Daniel again finds favor with the leadership, just as he had done in the previous administration, or back to Nebuchadnezzar. And so many of the other leaders become jealous of him, and they're trying to find something to indict him on, but they can't find anything. He's a man full of integrity. So they realize the only way we're going to get him in trouble is if it has something to do with his relationship with his God, because he's devout in the worship of his God. So they go to the king and they flatter the king, and they get the king to make a law that nobody can petition any god except him for a certain period of time. And the king is flattered and he agrees, and so he writes a decree. Now among the Medes and the Persians, once a decree was made, it could not be altered. So it's almost the moment he signed the decree, he realized that this was all a ploy, realized that this was a scheme to get at Daniel. But there was nothing he could do about it. They caught Daniel praying as he normally did, because he continued to pray. And what they finally did, of course, was they put him, condemned him to be cast into the lion's pit. And the amazing story is, as Daniel's going into the lion's den, Darius the king is saying to him, Daniel, your God is going to take care of you. He's going to watch over you. I can't do anything. My hands are tied, but your God's going to take care of you. So that night, Darius doesn't sleep. He fasts. He's crying out for Daniel. In the morning, he wakes up early. He goes and he cries out, oh, Daniel, has your God been able to save you from the lions? And Daniel says, oh, live forever, O king. Yes, I'm fine. God's protected me. Shut the mouth of these lions. And so Daniel's delivered, and the guys who, you know, tried to get him destroyed, they were thrown in the pit. And before they ever hit the bottom, the lions began to consume them. So that's the biographical part of the book. So that ends the sort of the biographical part. But again, it's a blend of biography as well as visions and prophecies and things. But now when we come to chapter 7, this is when we get into the real prophetic aspect of the book. In some ways, to me, chapter 7 is the most amazing chapter in the book. Chapter 7 is the chapter, it's the divine perspective on Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar saw the same thing, but he saw it from the human standpoint. From the human standpoint, the kingdoms of this world are this great image of made of these various precious metals. But from the divine standpoint, those same kingdoms are ferocious beasts. So it's the same vision, but from the different perspective. And so it's the vision of, it begins with Daniel seeing these the great sea stirring up, the Mediterranean, and four great beasts coming up out of the sea that were different from one another. The first was a lion, had eagle's wings. The second, another beast was like a bear. The third was like a leopard. And then the fourth beast. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth that was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So these are the successive kingdoms. Remember Nebuchadnezzar's, the Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the Grecian kingdom, and finally the Roman. And so here it is as well. But notice the Roman Empire is pictured as this beast that is dreadful, and there's something unnatural about it. It has iron teeth. Where the others are all natural beasts, a lion, a bear, and a leopard, this is an unnatural thing. And it's interesting, in the Nebuchadnezzar dream, remember, there in the feet of the image, there was both iron and clay, two things that don't mix together. So you got a similar thing here with the fourth beast. And so here, the amazing thing is, in this seventh chapter, in this prophecy, basically, the interpretation is given to us. It tells us, just as Daniel told to Nebuchadnezzar, it tells us about what these animals are symbolic of. That it was those empires. Now, the significance of those four empires is that they ruled over the nation of Israel. The Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and then finally the Romans. Now, in both cases with the image of Nebuchadnezzar, you had 10 toes. In this vision, Daniel sees this beast with 10 horns. And these represent the future aspect of this fourth kingdom. And this is where we come to understand that there is a second phase to what we know historically as the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire has existed once in its first phase, symbolized by the beast here, or the legs in the image of Nebuchadnezzar, or the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. But then there were the 10 toes, and now the 10 horns, speaking of the future phase, where there are 10 kings who unite together, or 10 kingdoms that come together to form this new empire, and ultimately give their power and authority to one person who will lead them. That's all recorded right here in the seventh chapter. So this is where you start to see the real strong parallels between Daniel and the book of Revelation. So we don't have time to go into all of this detail. It's amazing. But this takes us all the way out to the coming of the Son of Man. This is, remember, in the New Testament, Jesus is referred to so many times over as the Son of Man. That reference is rooted in this prophecy in Daniel chapter 7. There was one coming on the clouds of heaven like the Son of Man. So when Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man, that's what he was pointing back to, that he was the one who would come on the clouds of heaven to the Ancient of Days, and that Everything would be given over to him, and all nations, languages, people, tribes, and so forth, they would serve him. His kingdom would be an everlasting kingdom. That's all right here in the seventh chapter. Now, the eighth chapter is similar but distinct from the seventh chapter. It's a prophecy, but it's concerned primarily with the Grecian or the Greek Empire, whose head, of course, we know, looking back in history, whose head is Alexander the Great. This is where Daniel is so fascinated, and this is why it's been so criticized, because Daniel is prophesying the coming reign of Alexander the Great, 200 plus years before Alexander is ever born. So this is why the critics are saying, oh no, Daniel's not a prophecy. This was not written by Daniel. This was written by somebody later, like in, you know, the Maccabean period, 165 or something like that. They don't want to concede that Daniel wrote it, because that means there really is prophecy, that God really does tell the future. So the eighth chapter deals with the Grecian Empire. And then when Alexander dies, his empire is divided up between his four generals. And the one that's focused on here, or the kingdom that's focused on here, is the Seleucid kingdom, which would be based in Syria. And out of the Seleucid kingdom would come a king known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes is a type of the future Antichrist. And chapter 8, interestingly, leads you into looking at Antiochus, who has not yet come, because he doesn't come till about 167, and that's during the Maccabean period. But then it just suddenly transitions out to prophecies that are obviously beyond Antiochus. They're prophecies of the Antichrist. So Antiochus is like a type of the Antichrist, and that's what the eighth chapter deals with. But then we come to chapter 9. Chapter 9 begins with this wonderful prayer of Daniel for his people. Chapter 9 begins with telling us that Daniel was reading the prophecies of Jeremiah. And in reading the prophecies of Jeremiah, he understood that there were 70 years that it had been determined upon his people, 70 years of desolation. So Daniel realizes in reading Jeremiah's prophecy that the time of the desolation, the time of the captivity, is coming to a conclusion. So Daniel begins to pour out his heart in intercession to God for his people as he sees the 70 years coming to a conclusion. And as he's praying and seeking the Lord sends the angel to him, and the angel says, Daniel, there are 70 sevens yet to be determined on your people. So they're coming out of this 70-year captivity, but there's another 77-year periods that are going to transpire that will bring a culmination to your people's history and all the promises that God has made and so forth. So in the ninth chapter here, this is where we have the great 70-week prophecy beginning in verse 24. And we'll come back to that in just a second. But then moving on into chapter 10, there's Daniel sees a vision to Christ, a vision of Christ similar to what John sees in the first chapter of the book of Revelation. It's revealed to Daniel that God was going to show him the future, but there had been resistance in the spiritual realm. The angel tells him, from the day you sought the Lord, the day you set yourself apart, the angel says, I was dispatched to come to you, but the prince of Persia resisted me. So in Daniel chapter 10, we learn a lot about what's going on in the invisible world. We learn a lot about spiritual warfare. We realize that when we're crying out to God and he's sending help to us, the enemy is opposing and trying to hinder what God is wanting to do. That is laid out there for us in chapter 10. Chapter 11 is an amazing chapter of very detailed prophecies having to do with what we call the intertestamental period, that 400 silent years and particularly the latter part of it. Again, going back to the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies, these were two of the generals of Alexander. So the Seleucids took the area north of Israel in Syria. The Ptolemies took the area south, and they were based in Egypt. The most well-known person that from there would be Cleopatra. But in this prophecy here, there are, it's just this amazingly detailed prophecy about the things that are going to transpire between these two powers, the northern power and the southern power, with Israel sort of sandwiched in between it. But again, it at the end of the 11th chapter, it launches out into the distant future. And chapter 12 then takes us out to the time of the end. So it takes us out to the time of the end. And the interesting thing is, it's the 11th chapter ends, the historical element ends before the coming of Christ, and the historical part doesn't pick up again till at the time of the second coming of Christ. So the whole church era, which we are part of right now, the past 2,000 years, is completely skipped over, and we jump right out to the end of time, to the final days there. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up here in just a minute. But look at 9:24 real quick. 9:24. So this is the word that's given to Daniel. 70 weeks or 77-year periods are determined for your people and your holy city. Now, this is a total of 490 years. So, and this is what's going to happen. At the end of that 490-year period, transgression will be finished, sin will be made an end of, reconciliation for iniquity will take place, everlasting righteousness will be brought in, and vision and prophecy will be fulfilled, and the Most Holy will be anointed. So this is what the angel reveals to Daniel. There's still another period that's going to stretch out, and at the end of that period, God is going to fulfill all of his promises to your people, to Israel. Now, he says in verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command," so now the angel is actually telling him when this period is going to start. There's 77s yet determined, and now he's going to tell him when the period is going to begin. And so it's from the time that the command goes forth to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem. Until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So 69 of the 70 weeks are going to happen between the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem and the coming of the Messiah. So the amazing thing about this too is this prophecy tells us when the Messiah was going to come. None of the other prophecies tell us when he's going to come. They tell us he's going to come. They tell us the circumstances around his coming, his birth and, you know, things of that nature, his family lineage and so forth. But Daniel is the one who tells us the time that he's going to come. This is amazing. So, the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem was given to Nehemiah by Artaxerxes the king in approximately 445 BC. Some have it right down to the date, March 14th, 445 BC. So, 483 years now, out into the future, from that date, that's the starting point, 483 years out, Messiah will come. Now, this is a 360-day year rather than a 364-day year. If you take it and reduce it to days, it comes out to 173,880 days. I'm sure glad I memorized that in my 20s because I could never remember it today. 173,880 days. So from the time that the command was given to Nehemiah to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, March 14th, let's say with Sir Robert Anderson's calculation, There's some debate about the exact day or year, but nobody's far off from that. So you go out from there, 483 years or that 173,000, you come to approximately April 6, 32 AD. And according to that date, according to that calculation, it was on that very day that Jesus would have rode into Jerusalem on the back of the donkey in fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy, "Behold, your king is coming to you lowly, sitting upon a colt, the foal of a donkey." And you remember what happened on that day as he came into Jerusalem. "Hosanna, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." It was on the very day, to the day, from when the command was given to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. But the prophecy goes on and says this: "The street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublesome times. And after the 62 plus the 7 weeks, after the 483 years, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself." So here's the prophecy of the death of the Messiah. He's going to come at this exact time, but he's going to be cut off, but he's not going to be cut off for himself. And of course, that's right. He was cut off for us. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. But now listen as it goes on. It says, "And the people of the prince who is to come." Now, there's two princes referred to here. There's Messiah the prince, and now there's a different prince that's being referred to. This is the prince of the people, or the people of the prince who is to come. What are they going to do? They're going to destroy the city and the sanctuary. So here's, again, the amazing thing. Daniel makes it clear the Messiah has to come before the sanctuary is destroyed. So you wonder today, how did the Jews miss this? How do they not see that Jesus had to be the Messiah? Well, you know how they do it? They take this reference to the Messiah here, and they say, that's not Jesus. That was like a Maccabean prince or something like that. We don't really know who it is, they say. They don't know who it is. But yet, look at the details and the significant events. I mean, some unknown person gets cut off, and that's connected to the temple being destroyed. Doesn't make any sense. It only makes sense if there's a connection between the person that's being cut off, the temple being destroyed. These things are all connected to one another. And so, the people of the princes to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Who destroyed the city and the sanctuary? The Romans destroyed it, right? So the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood, and till the end, the war, until the end of the war, desolations are determined. So in other words, Jerusalem's going to just continually be in a state of desolation and war until everything is accomplished. And that's what we've seen for all of these centuries. But listen, verse 27, "Then he shall confirm." Who is he? He is the prince of the people who destroyed the city and the sanctuary. This is why the Antichrist, as we commonly refer to him, is not going to be a Muslim. He's not going to be, some people are saying that now because of the massive rise again of Islam and all that's going on in the Middle East. Some people are kind of changing their view, saying, well, you know, no, we had it all wrong. He's not going to be out of Europe. He's going to rise up out of the Islamic confederacies. No, he's not. He's connected to Rome. The Romans destroyed the city and the sanctuary, not the Arabs. They did that later in the 600s when Muhammad was around. So this is the prophecy of the coming of the Antichrist. We commonly call him the Antichrist. And so what does it say? "He shall confirm a covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering." So this is the whole thing of the restoration of the sacrificial system, the Antichrist giving favor to the Jews, probably most certainly to rebuild the temple, to reinstitute the sacrifices and so forth. And then in the middle of the week, What's the week? It's the one final week that's left. Remember, 483 seven-year periods have transpired. There's one seven-year period left. That's the week that he's talking about. In the middle of the week, at the 3.5-year mark, he's going to break his covenant with Israel. He's going to forbid them to sacrifice, and according to Revelation and according to Thessalonians, he's going to put himself up as God in the sanctuary to be worshipped there. And so in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. On the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Now turn over to chapter 12 real quick. Chapter 12, verse 7. And then I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river. And when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and a half a time. This is another way of describing 3.5 years. So what's being talked about now is the great tribulation period. There's a final 7-year period, all of which is going to be an experience of God's judgment, but the final 3.5 years is going to be the great tribulation in the sense that all of the wrath of God will be poured out during that final period, a time, times, and a half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. The tribulation is one of the purposes of the tribulation is to bring Israel to the end of themselves, and that's what's being talked about here. And so, although I heard, I did not understand, Daniel says. Then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said to me, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly. And none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And now listen, back to remember what we read in chapter 9. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. That is approximately a 3.5-year period. So you see, all of these things are connected. Now, when you go to the book of Revelation, you find that same formula, time, times, and a half a time. You find that same 3.5-year period, that 1,260 or 1,290 days. So the interesting thing about this is that for those who are living during the tribulation, they are given the exact day of the return of Christ. We don't know the day of the return of Christ. But when we say we don't know the day of the return of Christ, no man knows the day or the hour, that's a reference to his coming for his church in the rapture. But there will be people that will know the exact day. All you got to do, you don't want to do this, but all you'd have to do is resist the Lord, get yourself into the tribulation, survive long enough to see the abomination of desolation set up, then start counting down. 1,290 days, and that's when the Lord will come back. So, fascinating book, the book of Daniel. And, you know, obviously we could go on for months studying this great book, but, you know, all of these prophecies are here, and boy, if there's ever a time to probably sharpen up on our understanding of prophecy, this would be the time to do it because we have plenty of opportunity to let people know what's really going on in the world. What's really going on in the world is God is shaking things up like he said he would in preparation for all these things to, you know, finally be fulfilled. So let's follow Daniel's example. He was a man who he was completely out of his comfort zone in the sense that he was in a totally, not merely a secular environment, but he was in a a very idolatrous and pagan environment. But he didn't have a synagogue. He didn't have a temple. He didn't have any of those things. He was in a foreign land, but he maintained his relationship with the Lord. He was a man filled with integrity. He was a righteous man. And God wants us to be like that as well, out in the world. You don't have to get contaminated out at your workplace. You don't have to get sucked in and just, you know, be like everybody else. You can stand out. You can be different. You can be that example to people around you. And you never know the influence that you might have. I mean, who would have ever thought that Nebuchadnezzar, the guy who sacked Jerusalem, would eventually bow his knee to the God of heaven? But he did because of the influence of Daniel.